This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When race riots broke out in the U.S. military during the 1970s, Rupert Nikos was chosen by his commanding officers in the Navy to facilitate conversations about diversity. Those talks with fellow sailors thrust him into a career as a social psychologist, and they taught him that our anxiety over addressing racial disparities is stunting our ability to accept people who look or act differently. So he created a class at NC State called Interpersonal Relationships and Race. It requires a lot of discussion on race, gender, body type, sexual orientation, and other conversations that in other settings might make his students feel socially uncomfortable. His new book is called Taking on Diversity. It uses stories from those classes and his own life to illustrate how we might, as he says, move from anxiety to respect. The book was released yesterday. Rupert Nikos joins me today on The State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let's take us back to those days in the Navy when you were called on to facilitate these conversations. How did that go? What were they like?
Well, the conversations were tough. It was a tough time in the Navy because the Navy was in the midst of transition. The Navy had been the most intransigent when it came to dealing with race relations, and there were still large pockets of sailors, African-American sailors, who could only be cooks, and so the transition was happening. More and more urban blacks coming into the Navy, and the old Navy structure had to be changed in terms of how sailors interacted with each other around racial issues.
We're now pretty familiar with terms like diversity and multiculturalism. I don't think those terms were at all abroad when you were having these first conversations. It was new to everybody, right?
These conversations were all about black-white relations, so it was all about race relations. Mm-hmm. The word diversity, when it came to that, hadn't really been used. And we've moved from that is race relations, to now not just diversity, which is still kind of racial, to what I call neo-diversity, which is what you've just said, issues that have to do with race, gender, bodily condition, mental health condition, sexual orientation, and so on and so on.
Why do you think they chose you to lead those conversations?
That's so interesting. I am my father's son. There's a certain way in which I can't keep my mouth shut. I did it respectfully, but in one of those racial discussion sessions when I was just a member, I spoke up in a way that kind of startled the officers. And later, a few days later, a commander of the base had me called in because he thought this is somebody we needed.
So you did this without a lot of training, without a lot of preparation.
The Navy put me through a month of training.
Uh-huh.
Anybody who was going to be a racial awareness group facilitator had to go through a month of training. And remember, this is the military, so we're talking about 4 weeks of 12 on, 12 off days.
Yeah, but you described the Navy at that time. I'm wondering what they knew about race relations that they could train you.
And this is how I got into the social psychology part, because, in fact, the people who were training us were social psychologists. I didn't know that at the time. But I came to understand that. They had brought in people who had been trained in a certain way in terms of the scholarship and also group dynamics.
So what did you learn as a process at the end of all that about this conversation?
Well, a number of things. One of the things you learn is how to craft a group discussion, because you also understand the level of sensitivity in the room. America has done this amazing thing. We've gone through amazing changes, but we have refused to confront in our everyday lives some of these issues, and we still carry around a lot of sensitivities that have to do with not wanting to be perceived as people put it, as racist. And so nobody wants to talk.
Mm. Is it harder now than it was then when people weren't afraid to be perceived as racist?
I think it is harder now. I think the history of what was legal racial apartheid in America, which was so ugly, so violent. People don't want to look back at that. Right. My students are very clear with me about the fact that no one is teaching them that when they're in high school. They get this idea that Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech and everybody said, okay then.
Sorry.
I know, it's disturbing.
It is disturbing. It's funny in a way that's not funny at all.
Right.
So talk about your class and how your class is structured.
The class is structured around three things. One, it's socio-psychological, so it's conceptual. It's theoretically driven. But two, stories. stories. Right. That is, for one thing, I can tell a lot of stories, having grown up in the Jim Crow South. But stories ripped from the headlines that I bring into the class, and we learn how to analyze that using the social psychological concepts. And then thirdly, discussion, open days of open discussion, where I have instructed my students from day one that this is our safe space. We will, in this classroom, be able to talk about things you've never been able to talk about before. And that's the structure.
How does your telling your story about growing up in Jim Crow, Louisiana, help that?
It's very interesting. They really respond to that. They respond to the fact that I was a witness. That is, they've heard certain things, but it's all been vague and so on, and I don't go vague. I give two lectures that I title, It Was a Hell of a Time. And I just describe, using history, using my own experience, using stories, what it was really like, and the light goes on. My students, with that, my telling the story, and they're reading, for background, Tim Tyson's Blood Done Signed My Name. So it pulls it all together in a very personal way. They say, you went through that, Dr. Narcos. And I look at a man and go, yes, I was there.
But is it, I mean, I'm wondering about that. You're saying it works that way. It's amazing to hear that, because I would think for those who are harboring racist ideas or who maybe didn't even know that some of what they thought, it would be harder to speak out or to confess any of that in your classes.
So one of the things I do that's real clear, and I'm going to do it to you. Racism is institutional and organizational. You just said racist. No person is racist. Prejudice is not bigotry. Is not racism. And I make that very clear in the class. So everybody is walking around with prejudices, some of which they have no idea that they have until the stimulus is in front of them. Some people let that situation come into their outward behavior. That's bigotry. So what I do for my students is separate those concepts, and there's one thing I never talk about, white privilege. I refuse to talk about it because, one, it's not conceptual, and two, it puts white kids on the defense. And so what I say is, everybody in this room, there are no innocent. There are no innocent in America. We all are carrying around prejudices. Some of us let those prejudices come out in our outward behavior, word or deed. That's bigotry. When I do that, my students relax. All of them do. They go, we're all in this. Yes, we are.
And one of your first assignments is to ask your students to write about one of their most, or their most intense racial interaction.
Most intense intergroup. It started off as interracial, but my students taught me something. I said, okay, your most intense interracial experience, hand would go up. Dr. Narcos, but does it have to be racial? I went, okay, intergroup. And I began to learn just how intergroup their lives are on a college campus. Who are they interacting with? It's not black, white. Yes, there's that. There's ethnicity. There's religion. There are Muslim students on the campus. There are gay and lesbian students on the campus. So there's a whole set of things that they're experiencing that I'm not experiencing. Why? I'm a professor. I drive onto campus. I go to my office. I get ready for class. I do my research. I go teach my class. I leave my office, go back to my car, and go home. They live there. And so they are day-to-day in their residence halls, walking across campus, walking across the court of the Carolinas, in my classroom where the other class I teach, which is 200 students, where, oh my God, everybody's in there. They're having a different experience. They're having a real live experience of neo-diversity every day.
So it seems to me that you're calling attention to and bringing to a kind of mindful state a good thing biologically, the ability to discriminate. It's good to be able to tell the thing that's going to kill you, the berry that is poisonous from the berry that's not.
Yes.
Discrimination is okay. And then how we use it and how it shows up in ways that we were not conscious of. It seems to me that's the real thrust of it.
One of the concepts that I use to help students understand that is the minimal group concept. I mean, the minimal group effect. That is, we automatically categorize what we see into groups. So us versus them. We do that automatically. We can't help ourselves. In America, we have laid on top of that tendency skin color, and now we're adding other things where us versus them becomes interpersonal, and that's where the danger is. That's where we make real mistakes, because now we're trying to interact with a person that we're looking at in only one way. Just yesterday in my social psych class, we were talking about this, because I give this example of a young white man who's trying to wait on me in the Village Draft House. And when he comes up to me, he's so nervous, he looks at me and he says, "So how's it going, brother man?" When I said that, my class, they went in all kinds of directions. But then I said, "So why did he do that?" I said, "Well, he was trying to connect to your social group." I said, "Well, the unfortunate problem is my social group is professors. So just looking at me, you make mistakes. Brother man, what year is this?"
What movie did you just watch? But it does talk about the tension and people who are trying to do it. I mean, that's the other side of that, because I know you're not making fun of him on that score.
Right.
He was trying hard, but you're pointing out the built-in prejudice and yet the attempt to somehow make a connection.
One of the things that I spend time on with my students is that, yes, there's bigotry. There are people who harbor real strong prejudices and they want it to come out in their behavior. Yeah. But a lot of what's going on isn't that. Yeah. A lot is people just trying to find a way to connect to people who do not look like them, sound like them, or believe like them.
So you use, in terms of making it personal, I think one of the great examples in this book is trying to explain Bernoulli's equation. That's very cool how you do that. Talk about that.
Well, one of the things a couple things. One of the things I am known for is being a master teacher. And so a student came to me to talk about how to teach in a lab section. And one of the things I tell people who teach technical material is I tell them, you've got to humanize the material. And then I use Bernoulli's equation, which I know nothing about. And in the book, I show the equation and I show a picture of Bernoulli. So I'm doing a couple of things here. One of the things I'm trying to do is this book is filled with stories where there's a lot of tension. So to build a book in a way that people can keep going through it, I use various of my teaching techniques. And one of them is telling this Bernoulli story, which when you see the picture, you immediately start smiling because you see this guy, this white guy with a wig on. And it's a technique to help people calm down as they read some of these stories.
But in this particular case, okay. So you're right, he's this white guy with the wig on. It's a principle, and I don't understand it either, but it describes fluid dynamics.
Yes.
I'm going to have to take their word for it. But then when you tell his backstory, a guy who had to buck his parents or his father to get into math in the first place, all of a sudden people make connections, and
that's one case. That's really the point there, that all the stuff we're talking about is about human connection. And Bernoulli's story is so important and funny. And when I tell students this guy rebelled against his father to study math. Wow.
Yeah. Right. But it also prompted one student to talk about his sister's problem and with math and the kind of prejudice. So it prompts this conversation when you personalize it. And otherwise, Bernoulli's equation really sits there pretty flat on the page.
That's right. And again, remember, one of the things I'm doing in the course is using stories. Stories that help people connect. Cognitive psychologists talk about the power of stories as a way of transmitting information. And that's one of the reasons, along with the fact that I'm a Creole and we tell a lot of stories, that's one of the reasons I do this story methodology.
All right, so here's the big question now. You meet with a lot of students. They come to you. They go through the class. I'm guessing many of them come out changed. This does sound like a very one-on-one, very interpersonal kind of project that you're on, and we have 700 million Americans. In economic parlance, can we scale this up?
It's a very interesting question. My students actually ask me that question. How can we get more people to understand this? So one way I can get more people to understand it is to write a book and get it published and sent out nationally. But here's the thing. America is very complex. So we all have, those of us who believe in America in this way we're talking, that America is supposed to be about diversity. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. America's supposed to be about diversity. So each of us in our own little space, each of us, a guy who has a radio program, a person who runs a personnel office, teachers, everybody can make a contribution to this if we learn how to create a space where people can have the conversation. It's not up to just me. We all have to make a contribution some way. I hope this book helps educate people in how they can do that. and so that we can all start working on it.
But it still sounds to me like a very personal project. And earlier you said racism, that what is racist is structural, and that racism is a structural barrier. So that would suggest that without even a smoke-filled room, there are structural barriers to this kind of understanding. I mean, how do we get at that?
Okay, and one of the things we have to pay attention to is when we start seeing things that look like examples of pure bigotry and understand that what racism does is authorize and support prejudice and bigotry. So when we start seeing the awful examples of police officers shooting black men without concern, then we need to understand what's going on in that police department. What are the policies? What are the explicit policies? And what are the implicit policies around interacting with members of this particular community? Then we can start working on the structural barriers.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time. We are out of it now. Rupert Nikos, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Rupert is a social psychology professor at NC State. The new book is called Taking on Diversity, and you can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is the intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.